Hey everyone, just a quick note. You'll notice that this episode is much longer than our usual episode length, but it was a great conversation between fellow Florida enthusiasts, and it didn't make any sense to cut it short. So enjoy.
Welcome to the Florida Madcaps, your ultimate guide to experiencing fantastic and unique destinations across our magnificent state. Join us while we lead you on a journey of exploration, recreation, and conservation. The popularity of Florida's natural wonders is on the rise, and our mission is to be your go-to source for conscientious recreation. We encourage you to get out and explore these breathtaking sites, and to leave them even better than you found them, through individual actions and group advocacy. Join the Florida Madcaps as we discover the beauty of our incredible state together.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Florida Madcaps podcast. It's me, Ryan, aka the Florida Excursionist, and I'm here with the Florida famous Sunshine State Seekers, Chelsea and Chris, or Chris and Chelsea, or Chris Chelsea and soon to be Tori.
Thanks for having us, Ryan, as your special guests.
Indeed, all the above.
I know, I'm just hoping we can get through this podcast before Chelsea gives birth, because it's getting down to the line, isn't it?
We'll see. We'll see if we make it.
Well, you've been a trooper the entire time. So it was, what, a couple weeks ago we were together and we were doing our recording and videoing and everything?
And that's when I decided I've lost my trooper status. I'm not a trooper anymore. I'm a snapper.
We are going to go look for some pine lilies later today.
Yeah, we actually are going to be driving through the forest. We live by Charles Bronson, but we'll be driving through. We have a... gate codes because we're special because we're volunteers in the forest, so we're going to be for the Florida Trail Association, so we'll be looking for pine lilies and stuff, but from the comfort of the Jeep
and AC, because it's been a hot summer.
I hope you're successful. That's one of my favorite state forests to hike, actually.
So who's our real special guest, Ryan?
All right. So let me get down to it. So our special guest is a Florida author who's written a book that I enjoy so much and was a huge part in actually getting this podcast created as far as the inspiration. And I would like to welcome our friend, Kathy Silvestri.
Hi, thanks for having me. That was a great welcome. That was a lot of credit to me that I don't feel like I deserve, but I'll take it. It's good.
For those of you who don't know, so last year I met Kathy by chance. I had read her book and I was a huge fan. And she invited me to be on her podcast. I enjoyed it so much that I asked my good friend, the Sunshine State Seekers, who graciously accepted despite their overloaded schedule. Yeah, we cranked it up. And so Kathy gave me some inspiration and some guidance on it. Huge debt of gratitude there.
Well, thank you, first of all, but it's nice to have this little slowly growing, burgeoning ring or web of Florida podcasts that are positive. So I like having that option. And I think that people are ready to hear good things about Florida. So, but that's my shtick. But you were great to meet because I met you and you were volunteering at Marjorie Kennan Rollins State Park. And I was leading a group. We had done a weekend in Gainesville. And I did not want to do the guided tour. I was like, I don't want to take the group on the guided tour. The tours are whitewashed of her life. It's going to be a bunch of bull. And we really want to do the tour. I'm like, fine, do the tour. And I didn't really pay attention. No offense, Ryan. Ryan was the guy leading the tour, but I was in and out of the tour because I just didn't want to hear just all this whitewashing of Rawlings's life. And so when they were done, I asked them, they're like, no. He talked about her drinking. He talked about the lawsuit. He was amazing. So I went up to you and I'm like, I just want to thank you because you're the only one doing it. And we started talking and it was so funny because I was saying something about something and you get this really funny look on your face. You said, what is your name? And when I told you, you're like, oh my God, I love your book. And it was like this really watershed moment for me because I'm like, oh my God, people read my book, which I knew the book was getting purchased. It did really well. It went through two hardcover printings. The New York Times wrote about it. That, of course, helps because it does, obviously. I mean, so I knew people were buying it, but I didn't get a huge amount of letters. And one of them, there's a review on Amazon of the book, and it was so bizarre. It didn't even upset me. The person who wrote the review said, well, without pictures, the reader is left with only his imagination to picture the things Celestri writes about. And I'm like, well, that was kind of an odd thing to say. And also I got like a one star or something. I'm like,
no,
geez. Yeah, no. And so I'm like, you were like the first person who met me. And it was like in my 15 moments of fame, like a stranger fangirled me. It was wonderful. I felt like Miley Cyrus. I felt like Florida's Miley Cyrus very briefly. So thank you.
I was very boisterous about it. When she said, yeah, Kathy and Celestri. I'm like, what? I'm a huge fan.
You undid years of ego damage. So thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Around 2016, I was out and about in Old Town, Florida, and I decided to take some back roads back to Jacksonville, where I lived at the time. And it was areas that that I hadn't been through in decades. And I just fell in love with just road tripping through Florida. So I bought all the books I could find, and I got some that were just basically guides. But Kathy's book, Backroads to Paradise, was just amazing. To me, it is the ultimate guide to road tripping Florida. It covers so much history, some natural stuff, challenges that are faced by the environment. It gives you a lot to really want to like whet your appetite to do some more research. But it was basically a contrast between the roads today and then when they were a travel guide was written by the WPA.
Right. So this is interesting. And when I got the book deal, the publisher kind of wanted me to soft pedal that this was a master's thesis, because people think master's thesis, academic. Oh my God, I can't read this. But it was, it started out, I have a master's degree in Florida studies from USF St. Petersburg. And my first semester in the program, I was a graduate assistant. So I had to make copies. They assign like 5,000 pages a week of reading, and they run out of books. So they have to find like out of print stuff. So I was at this old picture, lowest bid government copier, right? That took forever. And they had me making copies out of this book called A Guide to the Southernmost State. And I was, the copier took forever. So I started flipping through the book while the one in front of it was going. And I just fell in love with this book. I mean, it was the front half is all kind of information, please almanac stuff. But the back half was 22 driving tours to the state. And it was part of Roosevelt's New Deal. They paid out of work writers. You had to say you had no money and no prospects. And I like to joke, well, that's pretty much every writer. And they paid them to drive around the state and create these driving tours. And the idea was that it was going to capture a slice of life in every corner of America, because they did this in all the states, the Alaskan territory, and certain city centers, like Key West has its own book. It was also going to put people to work because they were going to be writing the book and editing it. And then the theory was, I think, that it would also help on a very small scale stimulate the economy, right? So you didn't have money to go to Europe for the summer or the winter or whenever people go to Europe. I don't leave Florida, so I don't know. But you may be able to put a couple gallons of fuel in your car and take a day trip. And maybe you'll stop somewhere and get lunch. And so it was this idea they were going to get people moving and maybe get some money moving. The unintended consequence of this book was that after World War II ended, we started building the Eisenhower Interstate System. And so while the WPA had people writing about the main roads, what in essence they turned into were all of our back roads. So I live in a part of the state where everybody knows US 19. If you're by the Charles Bronson Forest, y'all probably know about State Road 50. Up where you are, I think what 100 or 90 or something would probably be what you knew. But nobody, 71, you don't drive 71. I mean, so it was this beautiful, it was like they left this treasure map in this book. And I wanted to follow it. And it helps too that one of the writers was an out of work Zora Neale Hurston. So it was just a beautiful, the prose is incredible. By contrast, neighboring Alabama was one of the last states to get one of these books because they couldn't find writers, and they actually just changed their requirement from you must be a writer to you must be literate, because they didn't have out of work writers in Alabama. So I had this beautifully written book. And then when it came time you know, I really would have stayed forever in the program. I love the classes. I love the field trips. It was wonderful. And Gary Mormino, who has written just a wealth of books about Florida, he pulls me into his office. He goes, have you thought about maybe graduating? The kind of university looks at how many people graduate from the program. You've been hanging out for, you know, 3 or 4 years. We think maybe it's time. It's a 2-year program. And I went, well, I think I'm going to retrace those routes from A Guide to the Southernmost State. And, you know, most people would have laughed you. I mean, a PhD would laugh you out of their office if you said, yeah, my master's thesis, I'm going to go on a road trip. But Gary was incredible. And Gary said, you know what, I think I can find some money from, he was an endowed professor. I can probably give you a little bit of money to help with that. And so in 2011, my husband, he wasn't my husband yet, and my dachshund, who's still around, we climbed into a camper van and we spent a month traveling the back roads of Florida. We camped mostly at state parks. And it was, to me, and I know this makes me sound like my world is very small and I'm okay with that. This to me is how other people would talk about the trip of a lifetime, like taking a month in Africa or something, because I thought I knew a lot about Florida. I'm a fan. I was getting ready to graduate with a master's degree, and actually experiencing everything about Florida, it really just coalesced what an incredible state we are, and helped me understand a lot of things that I think a lot of academics maybe don't understand about Florida, people with more education. Am I talking too much? Do you want me to
stop? No, no. Okay.
No,
I'm actually totally on like the same path as you. So I want to hear more of what you have to say.
So I am a raging liberal. I am completely woke. Like, I don't use the phrase master bedroom anymore. That's how woke I am. And I'm fine with that. But
Florida being woke in the bedroom, though.
Hey, that's a place podcast. To sleep.
that is how she got pregnant, sir. So Florida is a very red state, and there's a lot of ways, a lot of liberals, not all liberals, right? Hashtag not all liberals. They look at everybody now who votes for Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis as, well, they're crazy racist bigots. And if you travel to some of the places in Florida that vote for these people, you realize that these people have very real fears that we are not addressing as a state or a nation. And are these particular leaders pandering to those fears? Yes, I believe so. But they're being left behind. And I don't think I would have that understanding if I hadn't driven through these towns and seen how people live and see they don't intend to be racist. It's a side effect, but they are scared of the future, because they're not on even footing either. And I don't want to sound like an apologist. I think Donald Trump is a horrible human being. So I'm not saying that that's okay to be him. I'm saying that it gave me a lot of appreciation for people who can support leaders I am so diametrically opposed to their beliefs, right? And I think that's an interesting thing, because I live in a blue dot. I live in a beautiful blue dot in a very red state. And it's very tempting to say, well, you can, I mean, I have friends who won't be friends with Republicans. I'm like, well, that's crazy, because, you know, they're people. And I think that was what that road trip showed me more. It showed me all the different faces of Florida and all the different faces of the people. And it showed me that there's value everywhere. Like, I would have told you, I would never want to live anywhere in Florida that was not a beach. And I can tell you that is still 90% true, but I can see the beauty in a lot of places in Florida that people will just dismiss out of hand because it's not a beach, or it's not, I don't know what else there is other than a beach, honestly. I'm sorry.
I love those little towns. I mean, we've been all over the state too. And kind of like what you're saying, you can absolutely get a feel for their disconnect as we would drive through one to the next on. And the interesting thing about back roads, tripping in Florida is that you have these, you go through a city that it drops down to like 25 miles an hour. Then you're back up to 75 miles or 60 miles an hour and fly to the next town. But when we get to these little towns, you slow down. We're like, okay, where's the Subway? Where's the Family Dollar? There's the the Dollar General.
Dollar General is the scourge of Florida. It is the harbinger of doom to Florida, because they put out mom and pop businesses and they're disgusting. And Dollar General. Yeah. Dollar General. I also discovered a grocery store called Hitchcock's, and I fell in love with Hitchcock's. So
I have seen those in rural places, and they I think we've been to some of those. Mm-hmm. They are nice.
The first one I ever walked in was by Keystone.
Yep.
And I swear to you, the guy was stocking shelves. And I asked him something stuff, and he had like a butcher's apron on, not like the white tidy one, but like, I don't know if it was veal he was cutting or something else, but it was like, it smelled like sawdust. It smelled like an actual grocery store. And mm-hmm. they were so nice. I'm not a fan of the big green chain. So
no.
Yeah. Okay. I think we have the same reasons. There's something called the Fair Food Program by the workers. And how do you pronounce that? Is it Immokalee?
Coalition of Immokalee Workers.
Immokalee. They've basically asked some stores and businesses to pay a little bit more for the produce to ensure worker protections. And, you know, it goes all back even to countering human trafficking, just better quality of life for these people that work extremely hard. And some that you would not expect, like McDonald's and Walmart, have signed on. Wendy's and Publix, however, have not.
Yeah, I always like to give a shout out, CIW-online.org, because it is really, when you start to read it, they're basically just saying, we just need enough money to live. Like, mm-hmm. I food security is a big thing for a country also. And Florida, we have all this stuff growing. But yeah, that Trader Joe's has signed on too, by the way.
Oh, good.
And I think they signed on a few years ago.
Another thing that's eye-opening, and if you go to the grocery store and you're buying goods and whatnot, if you have any questions about this kind of stuff, when you're driving down through Immokalee and you see the housing that they have down there, I mean, they are just trying to get by. Yeah. You know, God forbid they get a couple extra dollars.
It's heartbreaking if you drive through any of that area, and then it is the reason I don't go to Publix. They refuse to sign. I will go to Publix if I have to, but I will not buy, produce there.
Mm. Yeah. I watched a documentary on them, and how they get paid is at the time of the documentary was how much they pick. And it is, mm-hmm. it's not something I could survive on or doing. It is extremely brutal work. I have a neat poster, because they had a fundraiser where they were printing posters, you know, like making them handmade. You paid, you know, a certain donation, they would send you one. So it's pretty cool. I got it up in one of my rooms. That's part of, you know, lower central Florida. I have not been to that town. That's one that has kind of been on my bucket list, but I have not visited yet.
Immokalee?
Yeah.
There's some cool stuff down there. That's where the crew trails are. There's a whole bunch of those. And then the corkscrew. If you're down there, you got to check out the corkscrew sanctuary.
Yes.
And so, if you're going to go that far down, you may want to just take a detour and go to the Atatiki, which is the Seminole Tribes of Florida's museum. And that's definitely worth your time, I think. So,
yeah, I'm a huge fan of a lot of Florida history, but specifically,
we haven't been there. That's on the Seminole Reservation down there.
It is. It's on Sam Jones Trail is the main road that takes you in. And Sam Jones was actually a Seminole who the white soldiers called the devil. Well, because we're stupid, right? We're stupid, arrogant, racist people sometimes. And during the Seminole War, Abiaka is his real name, but they called him Sam Jones. They couldn't figure out how the Seminole always seemed to be one step ahead of every attack. Well, what Abiaka did that was genius. I mean, he was a warrior. He was a chief. I mean, he was a leader, right? I don't know the exact term for what, but he was leading the Indian warriors, the soldiers. And he would walk through the soldiers' work camp selling, I don't know, fish or whatever. And he just acted, they didn't know what he looked like. And the soldiers were so arrogant, they just assumed that this dumb Indian couldn't speak English, and they just talked about their plans openly. And they never realized this guy was just walking around him every day. And he was brilliant. And he was just exploiting the worst thing about them. And I love that story. So it's Sam Jones Trail takes you right in. And if you decide to go, let me know and I'll put you in touch with some of the historians there, because the tribe is doing, TIPO, the Tribal Historic Preservation Office, is really working hard to decolonize the history, okay, you know, the white version of the history. And I am so impressed with them, everything about them. The upcoming book has a chapter about a Seminole woman. And I'm happy with the whole book. I was resolute that I was not going to run that chapter unless they signed off on it. And they did. They read the whole thing. The head of TIPO read it, and they said, yes, this is accurate. And that's a big deal, because we have a lot of books about the Seminole and the Miccosukee from people who have never gone down and talked to them. So mm-hmm. I was not going to be another white person writing about another culture. And surprise, here's a book about you. Aren't you lucky?
That's fantastic.
That was better news than hearing that the book was going to go into production at all, because that is not something that's easy to get. And it took months.
Very cool.
I really like that. I went down there once 5 years ago on a road trip trying to, because there was a couple different, I don't know if you should call them attractions, but something related to like the Seminoles that I wanted to see. It took a little bit longer to get down there, and Waze was not cooperative and ended up just turning back empty handed. So it's definitely something on my bucket list. So
I will tell you, there's not a lot of signal in that area until you get to their tribal headquarters. So you're going to need, I know this is wild, you're going to need to look at a map ahead of time. Paper map. Maybe even have a paper map in the car. That's a crazy talk. I know. So
I may have one of those or two. So before we move on to your upcoming book, is there anything that particularly stood out to you that really impressed you when you were road tripping around for Backroads to Paradise?
So I think the biggest thing was understanding that people who have very different beliefs, it gave me a little more empathy for why people think so differently in ways that, you know, it made me a little less intractable. But the other thing that there are a lot of things, so this is hard. I didn't realize how much I was going to love the interior of the state. I lived in Orlando, and I lived in Kissimmee, which are two very different experiences. And I liked Orlando, and I needed to be by the water. I didn't want to stay in Orlando. But some of the areas in the panhandle farther away, I was just blown away by. Very different feeling, very, very deep south. Goldhead Branch State Park, I liked it a lot, and that surprised me. You know, I went in with this, I'm writing a master's thesis, and I'm going to go in with a researcher's eye. And it became a very emotional experience. But the other thing that blew me away, and this wasn't actually a place so much, is that my boyfriend, now my husband, Barry, he moved down here, I think, in his 30s. And we were at Wakaiva Springs. And he had been to Crystal River with me, and we had gone to a smaller group of springs there. But when he looked at Wakaiva Springs, and it was this weird September day, you don't see this now, but we were one of maybe four people there. No. Today you go to Wakaiva Springs, you know, it was wild. Well, there was a big thunderstorm coming. And he just got to the edge of the spring, and he just had this look on his face. I said, what? He goes, I had no idea. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you talk about springs, and he was picturing these very small things, like the magnitude of it. And I think what that really drove home to me, now bear in mind, he was living with me. I was eating and breathing this stuff. I Florida splain all the time. So it wasn't like this was a new thing. But we have these abstract ideas we talk about to people, like with the Florida Springs Council and bottled water, and we talk about springs. But when somebody, there's nothing that replaces the experience. You have to be in it, literally be in it, and you get it. All of a sudden you get it. Because to me, springs are like these magical holes in the ground. And it's just the source of everything. And I at that moment, I realized I have to do a better job when I write this up. I have to do it. I have to do a better job of getting people to want to go to these places, because that's the only way we can protect them, is if enough people can touch them and feel them and see what I'm seeing when I go there. Not just talk about the abstract of, oh, we need to save the Everglades, or we need to stop bottling water, or please stop using plastic, any of those things. You have to really make people want to experience it, because once people experience it, it's transformative. And in that kind of, just realizing that as much as I had talked about it, I hadn't done it justice, really changed how I was going to write the book. But the time, the thesis, is I was going to write it a very different way.
I would say that's something Chris and I are feel strongly about. And we've talked about this before, especially, and I'm sure you've experienced this with people's strong opinions on gatekeeping and keeping things safe and secret and to themselves. And some things need that more than others, but unless people are experiencing these things firsthand, they don't care about them and they're not going to care about them. Maybe a little bit in an abstract way, but not in a way where they might be out there themselves fighting for it.
That's the whole thing. So there's this great piece of work. There was a writer, William Cronin, C-R-O-N-O-N, and I think it was in his book, On Common Ground, he wrote about the idea of wilderness and how if we want to protect wilderness, we can't leave it just as wilderness. You can't restrict access. You can't, people are not, humans are not going to care about something they can't experience, right? You're going to care a lot more about what's happening in your backyard than you are care about something that's happening in, say, I don't know, Yemen. And if we wilderness, we have to leave it completely unspoiled and don't touch it and don't let anybody in. I had this disagreement with a woman I knew over elephants and Disney, because she found out I was going to do a backstage tour at Disney on how they took care of the elephants. And she went on, well, their lives aren't good and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, are the elephants happier in the wild? Yes. Are they reasonably well cared for where they are? Yes. But if we don't, how many people a year see those elephants at Disney and get the spiel about conservation and all of a sudden care because they've been able to interact? And that to me, you know, that's it. You have to touch things. You have to be able to experience them. So I'm not a fan of gatekeeping either. I want people, there's that saying, travel writers kill what they love. I want people to go into the woods. I want people to go on a swamp walk. I want them to do those things because that's the only way people are going to care. There's just no other way. That's not my opinion. That is actually grounded in science. People have to experience things to care about them in any meaningful way.
That is something that we've been saying for quite a while. And there is, it's like a spark when you get to experience it firsthand, it's life changing. Mm-hmm. And talking about the preserves and why we need to have trails, and the idea behind that is the trail itself sure is like a scar through the natural land, but it's allowing exposure, allowing people to see these things firsthand and fall in love with them, because otherwise you're really not going to care as much about them.
No, if the people, humans are not good at moderation, especially Americans. And we have to realize that the choices are not a Dollar General, a Michaels, a high rise, a hospital, and a subdivision or nothing. Like we can have a trail. One of the things about our state parks that I think is so great is that with many of them, the part that's open to the public is a small part of it. And it's ingenious. I don't know if this is what DEP officials intended years ago in the 30s, but by putting the park system under the DEP and not a separate division, it's allowed them to access, you know, all this land acquisition. They make a small portion of them open to the public, And the public who interacts with it is attached to the whole park. Mm-hmm. When Rick Scott was our governor, he talked about opening part of Myakka to, I can't remember if it was cattle ranching or something. And what happened is people freaked out because people go to Myakka. In reality, I don't believe the part he was talking about was the part those people would, that most people could access. But what had happened is because they could access part of it. Oh, no, you're not touching my part. And that's, and it didn't happen. That to me is one of the beautiful examples of how even limited access can make a real difference in what we're protecting. And it's so important because it's what makes Florida so special. All these things, the natural environment, you know, I love Disney. It doesn't make Florida special. Myakka makes Florida special. I mean, that's what makes it special. Sorry, I'm just going to push the soapbox right under my chair. I get a little ramped up.
No, that's completely fine. Because that is largely one of the purposes of this podcast, to get folks interested into visiting some of these areas responsibly and enjoying them. And I've had a lot of gatekeeping discussions online, even arguments. And what I regarding the springs. And basically my final point is this. Yes, there are some springs that we don't have to worry about gatekeeping because they're gone due to nutrient pollution and overpumping of water, and the springs no longer.
Water.
Yep. You go to White Springs, there's no line to get into White Sulphur Springs at all. Nobody's swimming in it. It's because it's algae filled and barely flows. And that's it. So we're a little bit over on time, but I really want to discuss your book coming out next year. So can you give us a little bit of information on it?
I can give you a lot of information on it. You had Craig Pittman on here recently, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
I love Craig. Craig and I live close to each other. We will have lunch. Craig is the reason this book didn't get trashed halfway through. He talked me off the ledge. My book is the antithesis of Craig's O Florida book. It is, and I can't say enough good things about Craig because I think he loves Florida as much as anybody could. So I don't mean that unkindly towards Craig, but essentially, I wish we had time. I would read you the introduction. I'm really proud of that. I just found out today it is 100% a go. Like, it's been going through edits and the whole thing. So I'm just a little ramped up right now. But I'm sorry.
We can go long on the episode and I can do a little bit of editing of some filler words. So if you want to read the introduction, go right ahead.
I will probably read some of it. Yeah, if you don't mind, because I'm excited. But the whole book, the working title, and I hope the press lets me keep it, is The Florida Spectacular. And it is the answer to Florida Man. Okay. I'm standing in David Sloan's kitchen and we're all drinking out of a conch shell. Dave and his wife, Heather, live on Stock Island, which is the forgotten Key North and east of Key West that most tourists will not notice, much less visit. As an after brunch treat, he's lured us back to his little scrap of paradise with the promise of key lime pie on a stick and conch shell champagne. So my friend, Brad Bertelli, a fellow author and the first ever curator at the Keys History and Discovery Museum in Isla Mirada, knew I was coming down, thought I'd like Dave. So when I did make it down to Key West, Brad arranged a meeting. And so Dave created a 0K run, the Cal Key 0K run. He writes about the wonders of Key West and the Florida Keys, but he's also this intrepid Key West historian. He's published tales of somebody named Bum Fardo and other notables in the local paper. We're in his kitchen, and he says, "This will become a Key West tradition." And he pops the cork on the bubbly, and I'm about to refuse because champagne and all its relatives give me a headache. Then Dave pulls out a massive queen conch shell, the kind that you hold up to your ear to hear the ocean, and he pours low-priced sparkling white wine into it. He passes the shell first to Heather May. She takes a sip. She passes it to my husband. He passes it to me, and I underestimate how quickly liquid runs out of a conch shell. And the bubbles go up my nose. The cold hits me. I start to laugh. I'm trying not to spit it back into the shell. I pass it to Brad's wife, Michelle, who's far more delicate than I was. She passes it to Brad, and he's just looking very pleased with this idea we should all meet. So I head to the sink to wash the not real champagne off my face, and I'm smiling because Brad is right. I am thrilled to know Dave, and thanks to them both, I am one of a precious few people so far who has drank Barefoot Bubbly out of a seashell, which I think is the quintessential Florida experience. But the whole day has been like that. I'm in town to sign books at Judy Bloom's bookstore, Books and Books Key West, and I see a man who looks so much like Dave Barry that I'm about to go up to him and ask him if he ever gets told that he looks like Dave Barry, when the man next to him comes up to me and introduces him as Dave Barry. So I have saved myself a scrap of embarrassment, but I am not about to risk further mortification by talking books with him. I hadn't at the time read Best State Ever, and I was worried I wouldn't be able to refrain from chastising him for mocking Florida. It was only years later when I finally read it and realized that Dave Barry, like me, loves Florida for all the right reasons, even if they're different in mine. So I may be in town to sign books at my childhood idol's bookstore, and that book may have landed me a nice feature in the New York Times, and I may have narrowly avoided chastising a writer far more famous than I. But those sort of successes don't always work out like readers might expect. To wit, no one's paying for my lodging, so the Heron House and the Waldorf Astoria and even the Holiday Inn are out of budget. Key West hotels cost money, and our family's writer and boat captain budget won't allow that. So we've booked on Stock Island at the Perry, which is a hotel made to look simultaneously upscale and vintage. Stock Island belongs to the working class, the laborers who make a living off the tourists one key over. I'm unclear on how Stock Island got its name. Conventional wisdom suggests it has something to do with livestock pens, but I do know that for years you didn't go there unless you wanted a boat motor fixed, worked in a boatyard, or had plans that might have strayed from the traditional interpretation of legal. The small key historically housed boatyards, shrimp boats, and the underpinnings of paradise. And it also had a reputation for its unvarnished inhabitants who were not all interested in giving tourists a wonderful experience. So severe was the behavior on Stock Island, it was a natural place to dump a body. And that actually happened in Tom Corcoran's book, Bone Island Mambo. But just as Key West has changed, so has Stock Island. And today, Stock Island's a treasure. My morning run takes me past the boatyard, out to the water. Our hotel abuts a liveaboard marina. And so locals actually outnumber the tourists at the hotel, restaurant, and bar. This bar, by the way, allows dogs. And not only on the patio, I see one on a bar stool. And I do a double take, and the owner confirms, yes, he is the dog on our rooms do not disturb sign. Now, it's Stock Island and not Key West, so I don't have this huge array of dining choices. And at the time, I think it was either the Perry's Restaurant or Hogfish Grill. And I like to say it's not technically in Key West, but every time I eat at Hogfish, it's the best time I have in Key West. Nothing about the restaurant or the company who owns it feels like the spectacle of Key West. It's sandwiched into the marina across from pallets of construction supplies, trailers, and trash along Front Street. It serves food that costs slightly less and tastes more than slightly better than most of the stuff you'll find in Key West. And the atmosphere is very organic rather than contrived by a boardroom, in a boardroom by a restaurant conglomerate. So earlier in the day, before the conch shell champagne, Dave had led us behind the Hogfish Grill and took us onto the liveaboards to introduce us to the artists who were living and working on these houseboats. They're not fancy houseboats. These were not formal galleries, but they are studio and homes that happen to float in this hidden colony. You would not know they were there. They are not on any tourist roadmap. So this is about as far away as you can get from Key West, which is a place where once in the not too distant future, you could watch a strip put matches in and light them on fire. The matches. And that was steps away from the largest Cuban cultural center in the United States. My husband says it best. Key West went to hell when it built a Dunkin' Donut. People bemoan the loss of Key West to the cruise ships and the drunk spring breakers. But on this trip, I learned that the real conks, which is what Key West natives call themselves, find the real Key West in the places most tourists wouldn't dare look. And those houseboats are one such instance. Dave is peeling back the curtain on the Key West I thought was long ago. So before America had tiny homes, Florida had mobile homes. And this is where Dave and Heather may live. And they've maximized their space So there's actually a writing studio in the back. Dave's books, by the way, range from Quit Your Job and Move to Key West, The Complete Guide, to Roosters Are Assholes. And I think that that summarizes the way people feel moving to and away from the Keys. It also had a formal living room, like with a couch with broad colonial stripes, and then a family room that reminded me of a very artistic Spencer's gift store, if you remember those, circa like 1987. Yeah. Right. So there's guitars and album arts and odd bits of Florida on the walls. They have a chest freezer that is filled with frozen key lime pie pops and a kitchen that's easily as big as both living rooms. On their lawn, if you can call it that, which in the Florida Keys you cannot, they have plastic dinosaurs and a black metal horse. They have chickens that kind of gravitate towards their household, and one of them is named Cluck Norris, and he is waiting on a swing. Because they're teaching him to play the xylophone. In the backyard, they have a huge skunk ape statue, buoys, a full-size electric sign that says bait. So it's just this colorful explosion of a home that makes you feel Florida in your bones. Mm. But if you get a group of Florida writers together, one thing is certain. We are going to tell Florida stories. At the restaurant, among the houseboats, and as Dave pulls his fruit-flavored treats out of his freezer for all of us, we're trading stories. And so for Florida Files, which I know everybody on this podcast knows, nothing compares to finding Florida fans and talking about our beloved state. We relish telling someone new all our favorite anecdotes, like the one where we got lost in the swamp and I almost died from a snake bite, or the one where Florida alone saved the last big cat east of the Mississippi River from extinction. And when we do find someone who loves the Sunshine State as much as we do, who gets that look in their eyes when you talk about Florida, the joy is palpable. And that's when we come alive. And so that afternoon in the kitchen, the six of us talked about the Overseas Railroad, the two Henrys, and real peeps, because Cluck Norris has an entourage, and the Everglades. We talk about Key West because David is the authority on Robert the Doll, Brad's the authority on Indian Key, and I love to talk about the WPA's influence on Key West. We talk about Fred, the renegade Australian pine, who has steadfastly refused to die on the old 7 Mile Bridge. And as my husband says, well, everybody knows about that tree. It's not just a celestial thing. And this is how he refers to Florida things about which I am the most passionate, celestial things. Mm. And about Fred, he's not wrong. Brad and Dave and the Florida Keys Tourism Bureau all know about Fred. He's this rock star. He is a celebrity in a place that Ernest Hemingway, Hunter S. Thompson, and Tennessee Williams all called home. So we talk about Fred and Irma and Pigeon Key, and this is how it goes. We Florida-splain. Just as much as we love to share Florida stories, we love to hear them. So you know, give me a cold beer in a back porch and ask me about the Army Corps of Engineers in the Kissimmee River, and you have made my afternoon. Take a cold beer for yourself and tell me about Indian Key's stint as the capital of Dade County, and you made my afternoon all over again. We talk about the Labor Day hurricane of 1935, and that, of course, leads to the hurricane of 1928, and then back to Hurricane Irma. We talk about crocodiles, alligators, indigo snakes. We're trading stories about Archville Biological Station, the Cow Key Run, the Citrus Tower, pirates, rum distilleries, World War I veterans. I want to note that we do not talk about Jimmy Buffett or news headlines. We talk about Key West Pinks, Royal Reds, and Sour Orange Pie. Florida is a rainbow of colors and stories and histories. And once you know the stories, those colors all swirl together and they paint a breathtaking image. We pass the shell a second time. Over the next X number of chapters, come with me to find such moments as I tell you about some Florida stories. Tales that showcase Florida's spectacular side. Throughout this book, I want to bring you into that kitchen with me. So let's take a trip through Florida together, just you and I, and let's discover what makes Florida, as this book claims, spectacular. Down with the horrid tales of weird Florida, let's celebrate our amazing, wonderful state. After you read this book, the next time you're at a dinner party and the talk turns to weird Florida, do a little Florida explaining of your own. Over dessert, let your dining companions know that the rest of the country looks to Florida for guidance on how to create a wildlife corridor, or that the Walt Disney Company is actually doing more to restore the Everglades than the federal government, or, well, you get the idea. The point is, you'll be You'll be preaching the gospel of Florida, spreading the best parts of the state far and wide. You'll swallow that last bite of dinner and put down your fork and excuse yourself. And then I hope you'll go find a conch shell and drink your wine out of it.
Wow.
So that was a lot. I'm sorry. I know that's long.
No, I love it.
Really, that was fantastic. Yeah.
I have one complaint, and it's as someone with gestational diabetes and a lover of key lime pie, it's just not fair because I want to eat a whole key lime pie right now.
So I'll do you one better and make you feel worse. I had just found out a few years before I had celiac, and I couldn't eat any of those pops because they had a graham cracker crust. It was awful. But you can have key lime pie in just a few weeks, probably.
I definitely didn't need any pictures to envision all the things that you
could
described.
Could you reach
there
out to that reviewer?
your intro there.
That's what
and I love
for.
The angle.
I love
I love the angle of enough of the Florida man. Like, there's so many ridiculously and just awe-inspiring things across our awesome state that we could be talking about.
Yes.
I was sick of hearing how stupid Florida was. And the whole book, every chapter is something about Florida that makes us just a little bit better than anybody else. And that is my hill. I will die on it. And you
there's
know,
not many of those in this state.
Yeah.
Hills.
Yeah.
No, it's what I like about it. It's nice to ride a bike through this state.
Sugarloaf Mountain.
I don't think I've ever been so Florida jealous of an experience in my entire life. That sounds absolutely amazing.
And you've met Brad.
Yes. Yes.
And he was just so happy to introduce us. And it was like, you've got to meet Dave. And I'm like, all right. Cause when I met Brad, I didn't have a book and he had two books. And I was like, you're the snorkel guy, the best places to snorkel in Florida. And he was, so I have just, you know, it's nice. I feel like you and now you, Chelsea, and the whole group and Brad, and it's like this group of people who we're all celebrating Florida, and Florida's ready for it. Floridians deserve to feel good about something and a lot of things, and we need to talk about that more. And you know, there's no political chapters in the book, although I do think there are three chapters that might get the book banned, but I'm okay with that.
That's actually pretty funny. And so Kathy introduced me to Brad. And a year ago, I went down there and we met up at a brewery. And for about 2 or 3 hours, just had beers. And I listened to him talk Florida Keys history, Indian Key, Lignum Vadi, all kinds of things going on. And I could have stayed there a few more. But if you're drinking beers at a brewery for 3 hours, it kind of some point I had to drive, so I had to cut it off.
Well, and also it's the damn craft beer, so it's got a lot of alcohol in it.
Yeah.
It's not like drinking Mick Ultra.
No.
But Brad is one of these states. I think Brad is one of the state's treasures because he is, and Dave too. Dave's amazing. He and Brad are very interesting people, and Brad is doing a lot of good as far as putting out the word about the Keys history. I remember I was not born in Florida. I moved here when I was 7. And I had a friend who has since passed. And he was from Boston and then had taught, I think, in Maine. And I had this idea in my 30s that I was going to live on a sailboat. I don't have the money or the experience to live on a boat. I would have been a derelict vessel in moments. But he went with me and looked at a few used sailboats. And we were up in St. Augustine and we were walking around. And he was stopping and he was reading some of the markers and he just turns to me and he goes, I didn't know Florida had history. And I went, Florida has history that predates your beloved Massachusetts, but nobody wants to talk about it. Mm. And I talk about that in the book because Florida was two colonies. There were not 13 colonies. There were more. There were all the Canadian provinces and there were East and West Florida. But when the 13 so-called original colonies decided they wanted nothing to do with the king, the two Floridas were like, actually, we're kind of okay with it. We don't really want to do a revolution. That feels kind of like a coup, insurrection. We're gonna stay right here. And basically, of course, we were on the losing side of that war. And we've been written out of history, out of American history. And I Florida has wonderful history. Did you know that every pig in North America came through Tampa Bay? Its ancestors?
I know the Spanish brought them over. I didn't know Tampa Bay was the...
They brought them over through the Tampa Bay. They dropped off a head of hog. A year later, these things were running wild all over. You know, if you eat bacon, that's a Florida thing. You know, if you like pork chops, that's a Florida thing. We need to start really aggressively taking this back. But again, sorry, the soapbox.
I agree.
It's been a long week.
Sometimes that doesn't sell as good as, you know, the theme parks and the beaches and maybe the villages. But Chelsea, are you telling me somebody that said that Florida didn't have history?
I was actually reading it in a book, and the point, and it actually, a lot of my, I'm from the West Coast, and a lot of my friends from Oregon would tell me that too. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm a grave hopper. So anywhere I go, I love going to graveyards. And I was like, you're telling me Florida doesn't have history. I can find some really old graves here. I go there, I can't find anything that predates like mid to late 1800s. Mm-hmm. Like there's, and we're talking at this point, like European white people history. There's plenty of history that predates all of that, but I've heard that from many people. And then just saying we got St. Augustine, and all these, there's just so much history here.
Mm-hmm. We had two Thanksgivings. There was a Florida historian, Michael Gannon, and he actually had this great line in a book: by the time the pilgrims landed, blah, 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 St. Augustine was up for urban renewal.
Yeah.
Like, and when he got crucified in the media, they called him the Grinch who stole Thanksgiving because he was trying to steal Thanksgiving from the North. But I always like to talk, when I talk about the Seminole Tribe of Florida, I talk about how, you know, all the smartest people come to Florida, and so did Florida's first people. And, you know, it's because it's warm, it's beautiful, we've got beaches, we have, you know, mild winters. And it's laughable to me that when you think about how desperate people are to get to Florida now, people save all year to come here for 2 weeks. I remind myself of that when I get irritated. People dream about retiring here. And it's weird that we think that that would have been a new thing, that like, if you were coming from Ireland or Scotland or Great Britain, it's weird to think that we would have chosen to live somewhere where it was just as bitter and awful. And we didn't. The Spanish came to Florida. The Spanish were profoundly not interested in Maine. I mean, they did not care about the country, the state of Arkansas. The Spanish wanted to come to Florida. I mean, it's logically, when you forget about everything we've been taught, logically what makes sense is, of course, people wanted to come to Florida. That made the most sense politically, from a global standpoint, from an environmental standpoint, because we had not yet invented heating other than logs. And I mean, also for sustenance. I mean, I don't understand how we have all believed this national narrative of Florida as an afterthought.
With the development and how things are set up, it does a very good job of insulating. You can be in Florida and be insulated just from all of this, all the stuff that we love about Florida. Stay in your development and you can go to your job and then go back, stop by Home Depot and, you know, the grocery store. And then just that's your existence. You don't know about manatees. You don't know about all these things. Straightening of the Kissimmee River and then making it curvy again. There's just so much that's out there that we're not aware of. And I think my goal is to introduce people to it and hopefully that they care and want to protect it.
I think that's the best way you could have described it, because it's hard, right? It's hard for people to come to Florida sometimes because it can feel, I mean, we're doing this on an August day. We're doing it in an August afternoon where it's still really a lot warmer than I would like it to be. And so it's really hard for people to come in and embrace that. And so they get in the habit of, well, I'm going to go from air conditioned thing to air conditioned thing. But the reality is Florida is an experiential thing. Florida is not something you can understand logically. You have to really experience it to get it. And if you're just staying in your if you're just staying in the Villages and going to Publix and then to Bob Evans and going home, you're not getting Florida. And now, that said, though, I do take issue with the idea of real Florida, right? Mm-hmm. So we had a columnist at a local paper here for years who wrote a column called Real Florida. And he would always describe these instances that were clearly unusual about Florida. And I gave a talk a few years ago about how real Florida just gives birth to weird Florida, because what it is if you're not real Florida, if you live in one of these subdivisions, if you don't live somewhere where you can see native plants and all this, it makes it feel like, well, it's not real Florida. And if it's not real Florida, why do we care? Right? We don't care about protecting it. So it's all, I struggle with that. I struggle to remind myself that the Villages is somebody's Florida dream. Living, obviously, the Florida dream for a lot of people was living by the water with the beach. But for some people, having, you know, a bunch of acreage in Live Oak is the Florida dream. Like, I struggle with that too, but I have to remind myself that there is no fake Florida. Like, all the different iterations of paradise are real, right? Mm. But I do think that people who live in those more sheltered places probably need to make more of an effort to see some of our natural areas unaltered, to understand and remember why they wanted to move here in the first place. Because I think once you get down here, you can get overwhelmed by the heat or the drive or the traffic and go, well, it's fine. I'm just going to Netflix and chill tonight. I'm not going to go out and do bioluminescent kayaking, which y'all did recently, right?
Yes. Yep.
How was that?
Oh, it was great. I had a great time. Chris and Chelsea, I has been on my bucket list, but to do it, I got to go a few hours south. And I mentioned it, I think, during a podcast to Chris and Chelsea, who were quite alarmed and was like, you have to experience this.
So yeah, we live 45 minutes away about, so we do it fairly often. I mean, at least once a year since we started. I think twice this year because my daughter doesn't like fireworks. I actually don't care for them either. So that's what we do for our 4th of July celebration.
We camp as far away from, we usually go to a state park because.
Because you can't have fireworks. The same thing for us.
It's our tradition. So we have one dog who's super reactive. Now, knowing we're starting to see contamination in waterways show up from fireworks. Mm. And I'm like, okay. And I know things, even if I didn't have a reactive dog, you know, nesting birds leave their young. We should all be doing drone shows. You know, give everybody a set of headphones, let them hear the booms over whatever and do drone shows. But yeah, we always go to a state park. Our best 4th of July, I think, to date was St. George Island State Park in the Panhandle. Mm. And when, we had actually gone to a national forest and we talked to the camp host. We got there. We're like, so y'all aren't going to allow fireworks. We're like, we won't say anything if you want to shoot them off. And I'm like, Barry, we can't stay here because if there's fireworks going off, Banyan will bolt when we have her. I mean, she will bolt into the woods and there are bear here and we cannot do this. And so we called St. George Island State Park and we said, do you have any walk-ups? And he's like, well, we have one. I'm like, okay. Here's a situation. We can be there. I think it was like 2 or 3 hours. We're leaving now. And he was super nice. And I asked again when we checked in. I'm like, so again, no fireworks, right? He's like, we live on property and I can assure you it might happen once, but it won't happen a second time. Like it was, there better not be. And it's beautiful. I mean, it was a beautiful holiday. It was the best 4th of July ever. So
we had a very wonderful 4th of July, not far from there at Topsail Hill. So it's a wonderful, wonderful place to spend that holiday.
Well, we are at St. George Island again next year for the 4th. Y'all should do camp.
Yes.
That's should come out and camp with us. Bring the baby because apparently you're going to have one. Yeah, we have a travel trailer. We decided in 2021 to sell. We had gotten rid of the camper van and we decided to, I had a car, but the car wouldn't. It was a Nissan Rogue, wouldn't pull the boat, wouldn't pull a trailer of any size. And we decided it was new enough. We could sell it and buy a used travel trailer. And it was a life changer. I mean, it was amazing. We're taking it up to Occoquan next month for a week. And
that's a beautiful park. We were just there for the first time recently with the white squirrel.
Did you see albino deer?
Yeah, we did see the piebald deer.
Yeah.
Oh, I wanted to see one.
It was funny because he went inside and I was in the car being grumpy, and he went inside and came back. He's like, they have this deer and they showed me this picture and it's
the
great.
Ranger
and
has a poster.
And he was showing me. He's like, it was so cool. And I'm like, yeah, it's right there. And like, he's like, yeah, no, it was really cool. I'm like, no, the deer is right there. And he's like, oh, look. I'm like, it's right there, Chris. Look. And he looked up and he's like, oh my gosh, there it is.
Yeah, I'm super excited to go back. We were there once for, I think, a night or two on a longer trip. And our coonhound saw a deer, a regular colored deer, and just went after it. And we're like, no, you got it. And she fortunately listens and came back. I'm like, you can't kill a deer in a state park. That's a really bad optic for a Florida writer.
Kathy, it has been just a delight to hear about some of your Florida adventures and the upcoming book. And we'll have to have you back on to talk about it when it's released, because I'm very excited. I can't wait to read it. And yeah, maybe we can all go camping together or something.
We should all go camping.
I know.
Thank you so much for having me. And if I got a little effusive about the book, bear in mind the press just said today that the board of directors approved the final version and it's going into a pipeline where I don't have to do much. So I'm a little high on that right now, but I'm just so happy you're doing this podcast and that you're out there exploring, and that we're all, it's nice to find your people, you know?
Yeah.
And your people, and you care, and you want to do these things. So it was really great to be on the podcast. Thank you.
All right. So everyone, thank you for joining in. And as always, enjoy Florida responsibly.
Thank you for listening to the Florida Madcaps. We hope today's episode was enjoyable. Your input is important to us. If there is a topic that you would like to know more about, please let us know. The Florida Madcaps is presented in partnership with the Florida Springs Council, the only nonprofit advocacy organization focused solely on protecting our Florida Springs. Get a free spring sticker and join the Florida Springs Council at floridaspringscouncil.org/madcaps. As a token of our appreciation, we are giving away a free Madcap sticker to anyone who leaves us a review. All you have to do is send us your contact information to the email provided in our show notes. We will take care of the rest. Thank you for being a part of the Florida Madcaps community.